the end of yesterday's session on citta, I brought in appamāda in relation to the Buddha's last encouraging words, which were, with mindfulness strive on. And what he actually said was, appamādena sampadeta, which is the last line of the blessings, if you've ever been present at the blessings, when they're sung. And appamāda is mindfulness in a special active sense. It's to keep up mindful attention in order to guard against unskillful action. So we're seeing that mindfulness has got these facets, different facets. It's not just a fixed thing. So a little more on thoughts. And as you've probably been noticing, the mind throws up all kinds of stuff. And some of this is shameful. I mean, that I would have those kind of thoughts or images. But that's what happens. That's just stuff that comes up. We don't have to identify with it. And often thoughts come up accompanied by kleshas, by the defilements. They're accompanied by greed, hatred, and delusion. Sometimes thoughts come up and they're accompanied by wisdom, by wholesome qualities. Sampajana, you could say, has a thinking, this is a facet of mindfulness, has a thinking aspect to it, and this is wise attention, intelligence, clearly knowing what's appropriate now. So that's a kind of thinking, but accompanied with wholesome qualities. And the role of awareness in our practice is not to stop thinking. It's to apply it to help to recognize and assess, is this thought worth pursuing? Thoughts arise in dependence on conditions, triggered by the contents of the mind and other senses. When is thinking necessary? When is it constructive? These are the kind of questions we can ask ourselves. What is there for me to learn here? So not just cutting off, getting rid of them, thought, bad thing, it's in the way, I want to be calm and concentrated. Investigation. But not engaging in the content of the thought, becoming more interested in seeing thoughts for what they are. They're temporary and they're conditioned. And you might start to discover that what thoughts are often driven by, when we move into looking more at emotions, thoughts are often driven by fear, by some kind of insecurity. So we can take a different perspective on our thoughts. And yesterday we did a meditation, a led meditation, where we became aware of thoughts and thinking. So changing the perspective, looking at them, not from within them. And the perspectives that were offered were, become aware of the time framework of thoughts. Are your thoughts associated with the future, with the past, about what's going on now? That's one dimension, one approach. You can become aware of the kind of thinking. Are there trickles of thought or torrents of thought? Chains of thought, just snippets, unconnected, repetitive thoughts. You know this thought, it's come again and again. Or it's just the mind jumping about, monkey mind. And you could just explore that for a while. Get to know the thinking mind. And then we looked at the quality or the texture of the thinking, of the thoughts, pleasant or unpleasant. Yeah. And is this thinking, is there a heaviness to it? Is it dark? Is it light, inspiring, uplifting? Yeah. Sticky, relaxed? You know, you can be really creative here in your approach, in the way you're looking. Not creative in perpetuating the thought, the thinking, the content, but creative in, now let me be interested. Thinking's happening, a lot of thinking. Can I be interested in that? Mm-hmm. Is it obsessive thinking? Mm-hmm. And you will then start to notice the emotional accompaniment of thoughts, yeah, if there's one there. Mm-hmm. Often that's the case. And you might even, if you find this is an area, I can really work with this, the next thing you might like to bring in is noticing the arising and passing of a thought. Can you catch the beginning? Can you catch the ending of a thought? Yeah. And this is just fascinating. Mm-hmm. And become aware how you talk about your mind. I mean, I know we need to use particular kinds of words and terminology in order to communicate. We often refer to the mind as a thing. My mind. Yeah. So it's a thing and it's mine. Belongs to me. It's part of me. Yeah. So the mind is not a fixed entity. It's changing all the time. There is only change. Mm-hmm. And it seems the Buddha didn't really talk about citta. He talked about cittas. Yeah? He talked about fleeting momentary mental events in fast succession. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like... Do you call them thumb comics in English? No, you don't, obviously. That's what you call them in German. It's this kind of flip book, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, you go through it, there is hundreds of images, hundreds of pictures, and you flick through and it gives you one picture, yeah, or one image. And it's a bit like this, what's going on in the mind. Apparently somewhere, unknown source in the Dharmic texts, it talks about something like 17 trillion per second, which probably just means a lot, yeah. And neurologists are moving more of commenting on it's like 50 mind moments per second, which is still a lot, yeah. But it's so easy. Everything else is changing, and I'm observing impermanence and change, but my mind is this fixed thing. And it also applies to the mind. The mind is a dynamic process. Yeah. Moment after moment in uninterrupted continuum. If we want an image or a way of referring to the mind, yeah, which is closer to this, we could see the mind as more like a river, a stream, a flow, or even a fire. Yeah. And if you want to pursue that more, I highly recommend Subbuta's book, Mind in Harmony. Really, really helpful. Yeah. And yesterday I spoke about inclining the mind to the positive. Yeah, to goodness, truth, beauty, joy. Yeah. We had a beautiful evening around beauty and delight and pleasure. Yeah. So you can start to ask yourself, do I make space in my life for activities, for practice that make this possible, yeah, that are uplifting? This might mean the kind of devotional practice we were doing last night. It might mean engaging in the arts. Yeah. Do you make time to go to a concert, yeah, to listen to music, to read a good novel, to go to an exhibition? Do you give yourself time to actually be in nature? You know, oh, it's lovely, isn't it, looking out there. Go out and feel it. Go out and touch it. Be in nature. Yeah. Friendship. Yeah. Being together with your friends. These are the kind of activities that are uplifting and helping the mind to incline to the positive. And play. And if you'll allow me to, I'd like to indulge in a little personal story regarding play. When 2003, I had a sabbatical, my husband had a sabbatical, and we took the kids with us and we went to Australia for part of this year. While we were in Australia, I met a couple of wonderful Dhammacharinis there in Melbourne. One had also just arrived, and she said, oh, the first thing I did was I went to this fantastic toy shop and I got myself some toys. And I remember thinking, toys? Yeah. My kids have toys. I don't have toys. I don't play. I make sure they've got what they need to play. I'd been ordained a while. I'd been chair of the centre for 5 years, bringing up my kids. They were young teenagers at the time. So I was quite serious about life. And I definitely didn't play. Yeah. And during these months, I developed a friendship with one of these Dhammacharinis, and she was into creative writing. So I had time, I had space, and I started creative writing. Natalie Goldberg and Julia Cameron, and oh, it was just a revelation again for me. And in Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way, one of the things, if you kind of make this contract with yourself, I'm going to pursue this course, I'm really going to practice this, freeing up some kind of creativity, inner aliveness. One of the things you do every week is you have an artist's date. That is with yourself. It's a date with yourself. And you don't go to the exhibition with your best friend, you go on your own, whatever you do. Anyway, I went to secondhand shops and tried on loads of clothes. Didn't buy anything, but just kind of played around. And one day, I found myself in the toy department of a store. And I bought myself a teddy bear. And it just felt the most natural thing to do. And this teddy is called Curly Vatty, yeah, because it's really all curly. And I have this teddy, and this teddy, you know, as a child, I don't think I had a teddy bear. I had dolls, but I don't think I had a teddy bear. Yeah. And it was just this sense of play. It doesn't all have to be deep and meaningful and purposeful. And discovering this was a real liberation for me, I have to say. And I have missed my teddy here. This is a little aside. I know he won't mind me saying it. But, you know, my husband found it a bit strange. Curly Vatty's quite a big teddy. Yeah? And Curly Vatty, you know, is the third person in the bed. So he, after a while, he bought himself a teddy. But his teddy is like a scrubbing brush. It's called Scrubby. And it's like this big. And they would kind of have a little bit of a jostle. Yeah. Anyway, yes. So I had to learn to play. Yeah. As a child, I was really serious. Yeah. I was conscientious. And as an adult, I had to learn to play. Yeah. And I think, you know, I wouldn't want to miss it now. It's really, made my life so much richer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not about play. Sometimes we think we can associate it with going mindless, being silly, but it's not that. You know, it can have a real quality. Mm-hmm. And another positive activity that you could do in this area of inclining the mind towards the good is having a gratitude journal. Somebody reminded me yesterday in her review that she does this. No, you have a little book next to your bed, and when you go to bed, you write down 5 things you are grateful for on this day. And I have phases when I do that, when I feel, I need to rev that up a little bit, sharpen my perspective. Yeah, am I really grateful? Am I seeing what's there? Mm. So it's all about attending to the conditions necessary to cultivate, to give rise to love, kindness, compassion, faith, devotion, opening the heart, this expansiveness of heart and mind, to peace and contentment, to joy and delight. Mm. And interestingly, we often talk about following your heart. Yeah. And I think in Dharma life and practice, it's really important that we train the heart. What I've just been talking about is a way of training the heart. Yeah. Train the heart in the cultivation of these positive, beautiful mind states. Yeah? They don't happen on their own. What happens on its own is the habitual tendencies just carry on and dig in deeper. Mm. You know, and these evenings we're having here, it is one practice. Mm. We're listening to wise, uplifting, onward-leading readings. Yeah? We're reciting verses, chanting mantras that connect our mind and our hearts to the qualities of the transcendental, embodied in Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. This is a really important part of our practice. Yeah. So coming back to the sutta, which the section on mind, what we heard yesterday is that there are two sort of sets, two categories here. In the one set, the Buddha contrasts wholesome and unwholesome mind states. Mm-hmm. Is there craving or not? Is there aversion or not? Mm-hmm. And so on. And then the other set is looking at the presence or absence of higher states of mind, which I've just been describing with some of these approaches. Mm. So the higher states of mind, I'm just going to mention them briefly. Yeah. The Buddha mentions 4 higher states of mind that are great, unsurpassable, concentrated, and liberated. That's all in the sutta, the part on mind, awareness of mind. Great means in the sense of opening out. It's not great, fantastic. It's great, vast, opening out, like in the Brahma Viharas. It's that quality. Unsurpassable, yeah, is the mind leaving behind something behind in order to go to the next level of absorption. So we're not holding on, yeah. There is, we're opening out into going deeper and deeper and further, leaving behind, yeah, moving on. Concentrated, this is, well, absorption with regard to calmness and insight. It's not just about the concentration that leads us to becoming calm. It's also the concentration that supports insight. And liberated can mean full awakening or a temporary freedom from a defilement during insight meditation. So he's making us aware of these possibilities, of these areas of our practice. And in a nutshell, what these four higher states are about is it's our ability to monitor the more advanced stages of meditative development. Yeah. You know what's present in your mind. Yeah. You know what's needed to go further. And this, with regard to Satipatthana, is really interesting. Is there mindfulness? Is there concentration? Yeah. Is one weak? Is one strong? Now, these states are not just per se there. Sometimes there are degrees of them. If you're seeing a lot, but the mind can't stay with an object, then awareness is strong, but the concentration is weak. There's an imbalance there. If you're getting, you're getting sucked into the object, but there is little seeing, knowing what's going on, concentration is strong, but the awareness is weak. So it's really valuable being able to monitor your meditation practice in this way. So we're going to have a look now at the defilements, yeah? Present or not. Greed, hatred, delusion. And always bearing in mind, if they're absent, then, yeah, is the opposite there? Is there generosity? Is there love? Is there some degree of wisdom? And the first important thing is the defilements are not our enemy. And they have their own nature. So meeting them with awareness means we can get to know them. Like greed, wanting, what's the nature of wanting, of greed? It's kind of sticky, isn't it? And it's always got this like reaching out, move, attitude. Yeah. Aversion has more of a fiery feel to it, flaring up, anger, yeah, energy, aversion, like fire. Yeah. The nature of delusion can be this circling around, foggy, or rigidity in the mind. So knowing the nature of the defilements and their friends, they have lots of friends, yeah, and they invite them all in, yeah. So when they turn up, can I see them? Can I see them for what they are? And I'm just going to mention a couple with some examples. So with regard to greed or craving, eagerness can also be a form of craving if there's some hankering after a particular object. It can be an internal or an external object. Yeah, you're hankering after something, looking for approval. Yeah, looking for that affirmation. Where your sense of me is appeased, and that gives you a kind of security. Oh, I'm all right. Yeah, I've got that approval. I'm all right. Yeah? Sense of self fixed again. Yeah. Seeking some kind of gratification from the so-called object or experience. And how long do moments of craving last in the mind if we don't get involved in them, if we don't feed them? You can just pay attention to that, become aware. How long does it last? You know it's there. You get this feel of it, and if you don't feed it, what happens to it? Just watch that. Mm-hmm. Craving sticks to, it holds on to. It's like Velcro. Yeah? Do you know Velcro? Velcro is kletverband. Klet, yeah. Whereas awareness is non-stick, Teflon. Yeah. So you bring awareness, and that kind of releases this stickiness, this clinginess. And it can be quite satisfying and fulfilling to get to know the nature of craving and friends. Yeah? What does hankering after feel like? Yeah? What does wanting approval feel like? How is it manifesting? And this is where the joy comes into this practice. The joy, the delight in seeing a defilement. Because there is a chance of becoming free of it. Yeah? If you don't see it, there's blindness and you're lost in it. And it will just strengthen the reactive mind. Yeah? So if you see a defilement, smile. Smile. I see you. Isn't it? Mara, I see you. So moving on to aversion. Aversion and friends, yeah, manifesting in anger, resistance, wanting to get rid of, not wanting, struggle. Yeah. And aversion is, it might not always be loud or strong or intense. Yeah. Be aware of the tone of voice with which you talk to yourself. Come on now, be a bit kinder. Yeah. sometimes we think we're being kind or being aware, but actually we're reproaching ourselves. We're giving ourselves a telling off. Yeah. The self-judgment coming in there. Or we get fed up with something, frustrated, and then kind of comes in this, you should know better. Yeah. And that's very different to a clear no, this is not helpful, yeah? Which stands on positive, on a positive, confident basis. Joseph Goldstein has this example where he talks about working with the defilements. And if he's applied all the tools, he's really, really done all he can, and nothing has really worked, then he gets out his little pop gun. Yeah, so it's not a weapon. Yeah, it's a little pop gun. And in a very positive state of mind, goes pop. Yeah, no. Yeah, he just shoots it away. I think that's really funny. So there is a place for saying enough is enough, yeah, but it's the attitude with which you say it, and it's not the first thing you do. So if it's the first thing you do, it's mostly then there's some aversion being expressed, but you've tried out a few other things, you're very clear, your mind is stable, and you just say, no, enough's enough. Judging is another interesting area around aversion. Judging keeps things less risky. Yeah? We're with what's known and it's safe. I'll give you an example of this in a second. These are thoughts about the object or the source of the anger, or the source of the judging, and thoughts about the object, the source, just fuel that emotion, just fuel that mind state. And staying with that is we know where we are, that's known territory. It's uncomfortable, it's painful, but there's some kind of safeness in it. And I had a long, difficult connection, relationship with someone where there was a lot of aversion on my part towards this person, a lot of difficulties. And the aversion was fixed on this person. This person just couldn't do anything right. I was very apt in judging and condemning this person, and I'd see every little thing, and that just fed it more and more, and really got my teeth into that, knew everything that was wrong with this person. And this is what I mean by it. That's quite safe, because feeding, staying with the source of my aversion meant I didn't have to look at my own stuff. I didn't have to face up to what was going on in me. To the pain in my mind and heart. To the struggle in my mind and heart. Being in an aversive mind state, judging. It might be a place where we talk about projection here, but I'm talking more about this felt sense of the direct experience. By keep going out to the source, I avoid feeling it. I avoid just feeling the pain. And projection can come into this, to that. So our work here, our practice here, is again to unhook from the source or from the object. And ask yourself, what is it I'm experiencing? What does aversion, what does judgment feel like? This is a question you can bring in again and again, lots of places. What does it feel like? Let it be known in awareness. Let it be held in kindness and tenderness. And we touch here an area of vulnerability. I've been very, very interested in Brené Brown's work around vulnerability and shame, if you're familiar with that. It's something that is very encouraging and strengthening. And it's a strength to be vulnerable. So it's about owning this experience in the sense of taking responsibility for it. We hear a lot in our practice, probably order members say to you, take responsibility. Are you taking responsibility for that? In fact, this is what's meant here. It's not a head thing. It's, are you letting it be your experience? Give space for things to be known. And then you can engage in this changing dynamic process. You can't engage in the source or the object. Because you don't know what's going on for that person. And what we do here is, again, as far as it's appropriate, we look beneath the surface. We don't just stay on the surface, we look deep, more deeply. And in this area of a third satipatthana, awareness of mind, of course thoughts and emotions are intertwined. They're very close. Yeah, sometimes one is there first, the other follows, or vice versa. Sometimes it's more, it's clearly more an emotional thing. Sometimes it's more thoughts in the foreground. Yeah. And just this, a few months ago, I was on retreat, and I had a lot of thoughts coming up about my children. Nothing in particular, but they were recurring again and again. I'd find them coming into my mind. And I couldn't really do much about that, couldn't kind of get a handle on it. They wouldn't go away, they just kept popping up. And it wasn't that they were a big problem, but I just became interested. I thought, this is interesting, you know, wonder why that's happening. And then I started to investigate. And first of all, I thought, ah, look, Prasadavati, you haven't really let go. My children are grown up, they're adults, mature, independent, you know, haven't lived at home for ages. So my first thing was, you haven't really let go. And there was this like should and ought in there. Yeah, should have let go more. So there's like a bit of a stab. Wasn't big or it wasn't strong. And I thought, oh, okay, that's what it is. Yeah, haven't really let go. And then just went on with my practice. But still the thoughts kept coming, coming back. And then I thought, okay, let's go down another layer. What's the emotion? What am I actually feeling here? Yeah. And what I was actually feeling was, I miss them. Yeah. And I acknowledged that, and I just felt, what does it feel like to miss someone? And a few tears came, and I just allowed it to be felt. And this I can work with, yeah. This I can be with, and I just stayed with this sense of vulnerability, yeah. Not the strong woman I should be, yeah. and that's okay. I just stayed with that vulnerability, and just kept asking myself, what does missing them feel like? Just kind of gently turning to this experience, to the felt experience again and again. And what then showed up, and this went down another layer, was, well, they're important to me. They matter. Yeah. And this was just becoming more and more expansive and interesting. And then the next layer was, there was just love. And it wasn't me missing my kids because I love them with strong attachment. It was quite a different place. Yeah. And I knew, I don't want to suppress this love. Yeah. It's fantastic to touch that place and just be with it. Yeah. And this opening of the heart, yeah, which was coming from quite a different place. And this was a real lesson in this turning towards and then asking, what's beneath that? And can I have a look a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper? This is what's meant by being interested in your experience, not just taking it on face value and then making a decision or getting rid of it or bypassing. You know, it's a lot of talk these days about spiritual bypassing. Yeah. But we miss the lessons that are to be learned along the way and that we really then imbibe into our being. Yeah. Then we have delusion. And I wanted to say a little bit about this aspect, rigidity in mind, of mind. And delusion showing up this way can be when we're holding on to concepts in our mind. Or when there are absolutes. You always come late. Yeah? You never say thank you. Yeah? These absolutes. Or when we're fixed on something having to go according to plan, and we plan it out meticulously, and we really put our sweat and blood into it, yeah, and then it goes wrong. Yeah? Disappointment, hurt, frustration, blame. Because we didn't have a plan B. It had to be plan one, and it was my plan, and I knew it was going to be really good. But we don't have control over anything. Yeah, we can influence a lot of things, but we don't have control. When we have fixed opinions about things, this is delusion. Like the door has closed. You think you know, and you're telling other people you know, and you're also telling other people what their experience is or should be or shouldn't be. This is delusion. And when there's doubt in the mind, yeah, this is the circling, foggy kind of delusion. You don't know how to move forward, and you're doubting, and you're hithering and dithering. So the whole practice here in itself is examining, investigating mind when greed, hatred and delusion are present. Not just saying I'm doing something wrong because there's rigidity in my mind. I'm doing something wrong because I'm feeling anger. Yeah? Learn how they work in the mind. Yeah? And really know it as it happens. These mind states are a live performance. Go to the live performance, not a recording of it, yeah, that you listen to later in your head. Yeah? Be present at the live recording. So again, we're not trying to get rid of these defilements, but we're trying to know them and stop feeding them in a wise way. It's the wisdom that will free us of them. And know that defilements are visitors to the mind. They are not the nature of the mind. Yeah? They're not there all the time. They arise in dependence on conditions. And they lose their power when they're seen with awareness. Yeah. When we meet them with a dharmic perspective, yeah, for example, right view, yeah, and when we meet them in the framework of the precepts, this is how we can work with them, get a handle on them. And somehow they just then fizzle away. And it's challenging and it's risky, yeah. But there is great benefit because we're learning to be less afraid of our own minds and less victims of our own minds. So it's practicing awareness with courage and with tenderness. So lastly, just a few words about emotions, mental states. This is the place with which we most strongly identify, where we most strongly identify with experience. Yeah, I am so angry. Yeah, I am happy. I am good. I am useless. Yeah. And you know, there's a lot of energy behind these kind of statements, yeah. And we take all these experiences to be me. Yeah. So thinking a bit more clearly after what we've heard, what we've been practicing, yeah, and the momentary nature of phenomena, and I don't own them, they're not about me. Doing this, we're constructing a self on the shifting sands of experience. And that's a bit of a foolish thing to do, isn't it? Because it's just going to keep sinking, yeah? But we keep building it. Mm-hmm. And again, we're not looking for freedom from emotions, but looking for freedom from complicating them. Yeah. What's there is there. Not complicating them with all our attitudes, comments, justifications, yeah, rationalizations, bringing in another emotion to meet the first, to make it better, to make it different. Yeah. See it for what it is. So with regard to practice, quite a few things have already been mentioned, like, being with the felt sense. How's it manifesting in your body? Mm-hmm. Again, sometimes emotions might arise that we're not really familiar with. Yeah? But I remember, again, it happens a lot with children, doesn't it? They're your examples. that my son, when he was studying, and he was quite far away, he was at the other end of the country, and he had been having headaches, and is something wrong with his vision, and this had been going on for a while, and then he phoned me and said he'd got really worried, and he'd gone to hospital, and he's a really shy, introverted person, and I thought, this must be serious, if he, you know, voluntarily just goes to hospital. And I wasn't close by, I was about to lead an order weekend, and I put the phone down and I just felt, I didn't know what was going on with me, but I just felt like this kind of here. And I thought, this is fear, this is panic. Yeah. And I'm not that familiar with fear and panic. And it was this felt sense in the body that really enabled me to become aware of what was going on. Yeah. And then I was able to make plan B and not leave the odd weekend and go and see him. Yeah. But it was my body that helped me to get a handle on that emotion. Yeah. So, yeah, it's worth really turning to that and exploring the relationship between our bodies and emotions. Mm. Giving them a name can also be a helpful practice. This is the worrying about work story. Yeah, you feel worry coming up, and just like this, you turn to it in a different way. Ah, it's the worry about work. Cravings might come up in the form of planning what you're going to do when you leave the retreat. Yeah, and then you can just label that. Ah, that's the planning after retreat craving. Yeah, just give it a name. Mm-hmm. Or create a figure. If you're of the creative type, yeah, a kind of comic figure. Give it a face. You can give it a name. You can also give it a face. Mm-hmm. And I found this helpful in regard to self-judgment, self-criticism, and also self-doubt. I've really got intimate with these kind of things in my experience. And this niggling, undermining voice, you know, always finds a way in. So creative, yeah. Every time it's a new nuance. And I've got this kind of little puppet that looks like a witch, and I just kind of look at it and I say, it's you again, yeah? And that kind of gives me a way of relating to it, seeing it. Mm. And another little thing regarding self-judgment, self-criticism. Often on retreat, things come up from the past, yeah, and we see our actions in the past, we become more aware of them, and that might make us feel sad or upset. And just being aware, looking at yourself, the woman you were in the past is not the woman you are now with your knowledge and experience. And some kind of kindness and understanding, she was probably doing the best she could in that situation. Yeah. So don't knock what you did well in the past. Yeah. It might not be what you do now, yeah, but you did your best. Don't knock that. Yeah. And if there was something, yeah, that you didn't do well, well, you know, you all have your practice, I'm sure, of seeing that, acknowledging it, apologizing, feeling remorse, and confessing. Yeah. So this emotional work is challenging, and we need to go gently and be kind. Sometimes it's enough to just breathe with the emotion. Yeah. This is painful. Yeah. Let me breathe with it. And if it does get too painful, don't go into it. Yeah. It doesn't mean you have to then cut off or just stop practicing. Mm-hmm. Wise discernment. Go to another part of the body, yeah, where you feel grounded. Mm-hmm. Maybe your feet, your bum, your hands. Go to somewhere in the body where there are pleasant sensations. The mind can then be at ease again, relax a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Something Vijayamala's fond of saying, the mind can't be in two places at the same time. Yeah. So taking it away from the too difficult and going somewhere else. Mm. And another way of practicing this is filling the mind with something positive. Then there's no space for that is difficult. For example, if you chant a mantra, it's very difficult then to keep the emotion and the thought going. Yeah, if you're chanting a mantra, fill your mind with something else. No, because you know what you're doing. Denial has an element of ignorance, pushing away. But this is a conscious. Yeah, I can't deal with this emotion right now. It's too big. It's too strong. But neither do you want to just become a victim of it. So you wisely choose something. Yeah. That's not the end of the story. At some point, you may need to deal with it, turn to it again. But this is might not be the right time. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to finish then with a little comment by Ute Janir. This is a contemporary Burmese teacher, meditation teacher. One thing you need to remember and understand is that you cannot leave the mind alone. It needs to be watched constantly. If you do not look after your garden, it will overgrow with weeds. If you do not watch your mind, defilements will grow and multiply. The mind doesn't belong to you, but you are responsible for it.